Hello and welcome to the Louder Than Words podcast. I'm Jules Pretty. In this episode, we're talking about public engagement with nature through the lenses of birds and trees. How important is nature to us? How this relationship has changed over time? What does the future hold? So I'm delighted to welcome two guests from the University of Essex, Sean Nixon and James Canton. Thanks so much for coming. Can't help commenting, this is for real. We're in a studio in the 3D world. What a change. Sean, your new book is called Passions for Birds. James, your most recent book is The Oak Papers. And so we're going to reflect upon your writing and your engagement with people and social movements about nature. So let's start with a big question. Bertolt Brecht asked in the end of the 1930s, in the dark times, will there also be singing? And he answered this, yes, there will be singing about the dark times. So you've both written about our engagement with nature at particular places over time. So just a opener, how do things look to you now through these two lenses of birds and trees?
Well, I think what's very striking is the huge level of interest and engagement with wild birds. I think there are around 45 million American bird watchers, and the RSPB in the UK has over a million members. So there's a huge appetite and interest in wild birds of being drawn to their colours, their sounds, their aesthetics. So in one sense, it's looking very good in terms of the ability of conservation organisations to engage people and draw them close to the natural world. But I think that's also people are drawn to natural because they sense it's being in crisis. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, there's a sort of paradox. As people are drawn towards an attention to wild birds, it's also overshadowed by a sense of crisis, of them declining in populations, becoming maybe more less central to people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. James, your thoughts?
Sure, yeah. Well, echoing Sean, obviously, I think one of the things that we've seen in recent years that I've been very conscious of is shifts in the way that we've been writing about the natural world. In Britain, we've called it the new nature writing, and this has been a big movement within publishing, really, as much as anything. So books like H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald have had huge audiences. You know, hundreds of thousands of copies have been sold, both here and in America and around the world, translated into various forms. And I think this has been an important part where what we've seen is we've seen changes in the voices that are commenting on the natural world. They're no longer just, if you like, white middle-class males. There's a diverse voice on nature and a recognition, which is, I think, is absolutely essential to this, that we are of nature, that we as individual humans, even as we sit here in this sort of cube, we are still within the natural world, and that sense that we can be aside from, apart from, is just false. It just doesn't exist. And we've seen, you know, during these COVID years, there's been an even greater kind of desire, need for every human being, even when locked up, to connect in some way with the natural world, even if that's, you know, tending a window box or getting to your local park. And I think that's something that we really need to kind of capture, that sense of engagement, that sort of just the central human desire requirement to be a part of the natural world.
Excellent. So what we've got is a kind of inweaving of the social and the natural and the changes of that over time, and some people accessing and some not, and some having new opportunities, particularly in the last couple of years. But over time, Sean, the cover of your new book, Passions for Birds, has a fantastic picture of Billy from Kes, the film in 1969. And that was about... Well, you can tell us a little bit about what happened there. A young boy finding an opportunity for meaning, identity, escape, whatever it was.
Yes, I mean, so it's set in northern working class town, and Billy is a kind of loner and outsider who is bullied by his brother and is subject to the kind of worst disciplines of Britain's secondary modern education system. But he finds an enthusiasm and a passion in his relationship with a wild kestrel that he rears and trains in falconry. And I think it's about really what you might call more than human worlds, how a relationship with a wild bird enlarges the human experience and connects him with the landscape around him. And so he comes alive in relation to the bird and the landscape. And he develops expertise and skills. He talks to the class about falconry in a way that he couldn't do about the traditional subjects. So the connection with Kez is a deeply emotional connection that enlarges Billy's inner life and also connects him to the landscape around him in really intense ways. So it's a very powerful kind of story about the redemptive power of these connections. Mm-hmm. In a way echoing, James has written about Baker, J.A. Baker as well, and of course Baker's The Peregrine is also about a relationship with a bird of prey, which is about redemption and an enlarging of the human spirit through those relationships.
So. Yeah, as soon as you said that, Sean, I was looking at Baker this morning because there's been some artwork commissioned in Chelmsford, which is really interesting to see, based on Baker. But Baker as well, was very much struggling within his mental health and found this kind of, a peace, if you like, by following the last of the falcons of Essex at that period. So really nice connection. I like that.
And I think Baker, it's about how birds are mediating the relationship to place and landscape. And what's wonderful about The Peregrine is the way it just reimagines the Essex countryside.
Yeah.
This really kind of neglected, disparaged,
forgotten,
not like the kind of grand moors of the north or the Lake District. Yeah. But it's the bird enchants that landscape for him, and you see it in a new way and it matters to look after it and connect with it.
In 1949, Joseph Campbell wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces and about the kind of journey that we go on out of ordinary world into special world and how, you overcome all sorts of difficulties and eventually come back again, having conquered the dragon or the come back with the elixir of life. And then, of course, back into the ordinary world, people say, well, it's time to do the laundry. It's still an ordinary world from the special bit. But it struck me that in those examples of Kez, but also J.A. Baker himself and others, you go out of where you find yourself. You may be suffering from mental health issues or maybe in a particular kind of job that's not fun or interesting, and then out there something different happens. So there's a stepping across a threshold into another kind of world. I mean, is that what we see with Baker when he's...
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what we see with Baker, and it's interesting that Baker is of his time, and one of the geniuses of what he does is he creates a text which essentially starts to see the world through the peregrine's eyes. So he strips the world of its kind of humanity, if you like, in some ways, certainly of its kind of human constructs. And I think this is Baker's book, The Peregrine, 1967, is very much seen as a sort of precursor to the new nature writing in the way in which largely it's just a brilliantly written book, but then every now and again he steps in. And he steps in with a sort of first-person narrative and an outrage at what humans are doing to the natural world, are doing to. And this was a time of DDT. There's a brilliant scene that he writes based around the winter of 62, where he's just seen a heron dying with its wings frozen to the ground, and he's outraged that as he steps over to put this bird out of its misery, it's terrified of seeing a human being. And this sense we need to get beyond this. And this kind of anger, I think, is also an important part of the book.
It's obviously a dialogue with Rachel Carson, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is a kind of... She is the key interlocutor for him. And it is about... What's he say? To look at the natural world is to see the shadow of death, which is, very Carsonian view that... And also, as you say, that is about the interconnection with the natural world, that we are part of the web of life, which is what Carson is showing.
Yeah.
The DDT is in the mother's milk. We are not separate from nature. We are absolutely interdependent and dependent upon it as organically embodied entities. So, but I mean, what that means, as it were, in terms of kind of ecological writing, is there in Baker, isn't it? We are part of, and as you say, that his sort of trauma of the reaction of the birds to him, because humans are a threat, and that's
right.
Traumatic.
And we don't want to. I mean, we recognise that now. I think it's now our position is to step on from Silent Spring, you know, 1962, Baker, the Peregrine 67, you know, and kind of use them as our kind of precursor texts, you know, to open our eyes, if you like. And I think, you know, a modern writer, someone like Kathleen Jamie, who writes a series of essays called Findings, was her first collection of essays, which are brilliant, and they're very much sort of stepping on. She literally steps on Baker's toes, references him in the text, and is watching the Peregrines while doing the washing up, while getting the washing into the washing machine before she picks up the kids from school. And this kind of like recognition of the everyday, I think, is a really important part that, you know, we all are part of this.
There's something about attentiveness in this as well, kind of being very aware of what you can see and what you will discover when you're out there, maybe looking through the kitchen window, or you're deep in kind of what we might think of as wilderness, or Kathleen Jamie on the Gannet Rock, or a whole range of other sorts of contexts. But that attentiveness, clearly that shaped Rachel Carson's way of seeing the world. There was a scientific assessment, but also an attentiveness first to the sea and then to the birds and their disappearance. It's interesting when you compare that with, at the same time, Ayn Rand was coming forward and writing books about the importance of selfishness and how individualism runs the world, and how that leads into the emergence of neoliberalism a little bit later on, and she becomes this kind of star of a particular kind of set of views about the world, maybe shaped by the President of the United States in the 1980s, Reagan, when he said, once you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. And there was something about kind of individualism as well as just kind of generality that you can dismiss it.
I think there's something interesting about sound, though, in Carson, which is sort of neglected. It's called Silent Spring. And the power of that title is about what would the world be like without birdsong. And I think that is a really deep preoccupation through the 20th century, and it, particularly after the First World War, where birdsong in the First World War is a counterpoint to the carnage of the Western Front. Soldiers hearing birdsong after battle. Sebastian Falk's famous book about the First World War is called Birdsong. And it connects with a wider interest, I think, from the BBC in this period of using recordings of bird sound to heal the kind of damages of modern industrial technological society. So they obviously, you know, one of the first outside broadcasts is of Beatrice Harrison playing her cello with the nightingale accompanying her. And I think there's a deep sense that birdsong is it has this power in a modern technological society to heal something in humans. And I think
did you not think that in the film 1917, when he's been through the fire and the flame and then floating down the river and then comes up into the I know the timing of the time of year is not quite perfect, but the beautiful forest full of oaks. There's the bird song. It's green and beautiful. And then the young soldier stands up and sings the hymn. And it is bird song that brings him back into the world. And for them all, it's a moment of calm before the hell that's to follow. And that's an echo of that bird song as well.
Well, it's Eden, isn't it? It's our return to our paradise, if you like. But obviously, we're not all living in that Edenic world anymore. And I think, you know, absolutely. I mean, it's a good point, bringing in that kind of the sensory layering to the modern nature writing text is so important. It's so important. But, you know, some of the best books recently, I really like The Urban Birder, David Lindo, who's very much, you know, recognising that we don't all live in fields, that we have birdsong that we can go to. But even within an urban setting, you can still appreciate, you know, the wonder of the bird kind of thing.
I think that's interesting, because I think it's about, and this is something that Richard Mabey's talked about relationship with the common and the ordinary and the everyday birds that are around your house, your garden, your local park, and those being really important. And in a way, if there's a criticism of conservation, they've tended to focus on the exotic, the rare, the bittern, the osprey, the exceptional in a way. You have to go to special places to see them. And in a way, it constructed a relationship with wild birds that was about these rare and scarce species that you had these intense encounters. But actually, clearly, as Lindo talks about, you know, a black kid in London, it's the local birds that are really important.
Absolutely.
Relationship with starlings and robins and the birds in your back garden feeder. Yeah. You know, I think are really, really lift people's spirits in a really, in a very direct way of encountering the natural world.
Yeah, and on that every day. Like, you don't have to leave your home and go on some great expedition around the world. Yeah. You know, you're at home.
Mm.
You're
or equally, the local bit of nature is a great expedition in itself.
Absolutely.
And that's another way of kind of looking at it. Yeah. Well, let's go back a little bit, Coach, to the social movements that kind of shape some of these things. Mm. So the emergence of RSPB in the UK, the National Trust, occurs because of people's concerns about consumption and overconsumption, particularly of fur and feathers, which leads to the Fur and Feather League. And three women, Eliza Phillips, Emily Williamson and Etta Lemon, who get together in the late 1800s and because of their concern about birds being killed and the feathers being used by milliners to go on hats and the, you know, very, very kind of highly visible nature of consumption because it's designed to be highly visible. And the effect that they have, and then Octavia Hill comes along and helps to shape the National Trust. So just say something about that, kind of how those social movements emerge out of a space which interests me about how we live. For example, we were talking about birdsong. When you listen to birdsong, you could say consume it. Afterwards, the birds are still there. But other forms of consumption, when we use them up, they're not there anymore. Actually, what they've done is cause some damage, that consumption. But consumption of nature, still kind of problematic term, but you know, our engagement with, leaves it still there afterwards. You watch the sunset, it's still there. You listen to the birds, they're still there afterwards. And there's something very interesting about that. But if we go back to those early social movements and how they led to this kind of interest in
I mean, I think they're driven by, I mean, in the case of National Trust, obviously they're driven by a response to, you know, late 19th century industrialization, urbanization and development, where suddenly the English countryside that looked like an infinite resource is suddenly being eroded, and so there's absolutely a response to what you might call an environmental crisis of that moment, which is different from the one we're in now, but it is equally powerful. So preserving the landscape from further development was absolutely central. And I think because people like Trevelyan, you know, in the 30s, who's a key supporter of the National Trust, historian, you know, those landscapes are part of a national heritage. They matter to a sense of the national identity. And open air, uncultivated landscapes offer renewal, and fresh air as well. We mustn't forget, fresh air is a really important part of the debate because of the terrible conditions of urban living in the late 19th century. So trying to sort of protect the landscape from the worst excesses of industrialization and modern life is very important for the National Trust. And as you say, the RSPB is a kind of consumer activist movement in its formation. I mean, about protecting wild birds from the unsustainable use of their feathers in millinery. I mean, what's interesting about RSPB is how it shifts from that campaign to then become more about conservation and buying land. Yeah. And, you know, it shifts really from a very single issue campaign to a broader idea of protecting birds is about their habitats, not just about stopping them being shot and used. So, I mean, that's very interesting. And I suppose that they then are drawn onto the same terrain as the National Trust, which is actually buying land becomes the kind of great 20th century principle of conservation, preserving, fencing off land as a way of dealing with the threats to it.
Which is interesting, isn't it? In that kind of 19th century, one of the big issues is enclosure and the removal of the common land, as you kind of mentioned with Mabey, etc. I think there's something going on with that now, that we have this sense of these, you know, large organisations, largely to do good, but also kind of removing land from the public, if you like. And, you know, we see this, I mean, we should mention, I'd like to mention Woodland Trust as well at this point, because I think they're a really important organisation. And they are happy to be a little bit more outstated about their concern, say, for the loss of ancient woodland in Britain, which is a real issue. And again, I think continually isn't kind of flagged up. We know the importance of trees. We know the importance of trees with climate change, etc. But continually, you still have developers who will take out bits of ancient woodland, take the hit of the fine, and no one really does anything about it. And without this governmental action, we are seeing the gradual erosion of ancient woodland in Britain. The whole issue of trees brings in a kind of a whole other kind of realm. I mean, we kind of quite happily accept that individual birds are living creatures that should be kind of not killed, really. I'm not quite sure if we're there yet with recognizing that trees are also individual living creatures.
Communities of living, communities, aren't they? Wood is a community of living beings.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, the fascinating research on the fungal connections between trees has just opened up, I think, a new way of kind of seeing a world, partly because that's it was hidden anyway, but then to find that the ancient oak trees within a woodland is not just an individual sitting there, but through the roots and the fungal hyphae, they're sharing resources with other trees. They're sending signals about pests to kind of gear up your defences. Some of the original research on this in the northwest of the United States and into Canada is finding individual Douglas firs with 200 connections to other trees.
This is Suzanne Simard, isn't it?
Yeah, Suzanne, I mean, exactly.
This is the figure we should
fantastic
be referencing.
You know, understanding of, and someone who was drummed out of her work, working for the Forest Service in Canada, because, partly because she was a woman, but also she was saying, well, actually, these trees you think of as weeds, birch trees, actually, they're helping to maintain the firs, which you want to cut down and sell. Mm. But I think one of the big lessons that I got from all of that was that the ancient old trees, if you take them out because there's a lot of wood in them, you know, you sort of selectively harvest or some kind of language like that, actually, you damage the whole system because they're the ones that have got all the connections to all the youngsters and they're bringing them along and sharing resources in tough times.
That's right.
Suddenly, we see nature in quite a different way when we think of those kind of connectivity, which perhaps is more difficult with plants than kind of communities of birds. I don't know.
It feels like it's an extra step, isn't it? But I think it's a step, you know, if you like, it's a step into animism that is more difficult to take, perhaps, than the robin that flies onto our balcony. But Suzanne Simard's work is, I think, will be seen as absolutely, you know, incredibly important. And it already is. As you mentioned, Jules, the idea of the mother tree, this is this concept. And her recent book, it's a great, easy read, really, in a lot of ways, Finding the Mother Tree, which is sort of part of her own memoir of this journey that she's come on from British Columbia and this incredible research she's done into these mitochondrial connections. You know, and other people have taken this on. I was chatting with Merlin Sheldrake, who's a brilliant kind of like Cambridge genius.
I've just read his new book. It's very, very good, actually. It's a good
fungi,
summary.
Which is, again, is about this, you know, this level of kind of life that's going on that we don't see so obviously when we're standing on our flat balcony, whereas we might see, you know, a wren flying past. But I think I've been fortunate with publishing the Oak Papers to get a lot of people contacting me saying, oh, that's so good, because I've got a favourite tree and I go to that. Or, you know, I got a really nice email the other day just from someone in America saying, you know, oh, that's so cool, because, you know, I had this favourite oak that I used to go to, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, and, you know, now it's a fast food restaurant, you know, and this kind of was a bit like, oh, okay. But
I think that's interesting, is that what we then see is this kind of emergence of something that was there already, a deep sense of care, which actually then could translate into, at a kind of higher level, action and then policies, because people are individually caring. And so just how then, because there are some things we didn't know and then we know, and then knowing them is kind of helpful, like fungi underground or the migration of birds and the kind of miraculous nature of that. We didn't know that swallows flew to Africa and back again until when? Like middle 1800s, 1900s.
And I think it's probably, the chimney swift in America, I mean, it's not, which migrates to Peru, they don't find that out until 1938.
Wow. That's great, isn't it?
I mean, it's so recent.
Yeah.
But the cosmopolitan lives of birds are really instructive, I think, this kind of movement around the globe and their connection to different landscapes and places, you know. And we tend to, there's been a strong tradition in natural history, nature writing, to root animals in what you might call national nature. our national birds, our national trees.
Our
backyards, our skylarks. And then I think Norfolk farmers in the 30s got annoyed when they found out that they were German skylarks actually coming in for the winter, eating their grain. That sort of cosmopolitan ethic, if you like, the mobility of these birds' lives, they're partly with us, they're partly somewhere else. That's really, I think, really pushes against those forms of nationalism within nature, natural history.
So true. And I was looking at oaks, and I always thought, well, it's an English oak, obviously, it's an English oak. Okay, but it's also the national tree of Germany, Latvia, America. You start looking around, and because oaks are all over the Northern Hemisphere, everywhere they grow, they're the national tree, pretty much, that kind of thing.
I always thought it was fascinating. But went to Stellenbosch in Cape South Africa. The kind of part of the kind of Afrikaner's making of that landscape to exclude the African in a way was to bring in loads of oak trees down the high street of Stellenbosch.
Happened in Australia and
New
Zealand. So
we're using
as well.
Trees as a kind of weapon of cultural change and
colonial,
kind of,
colonial
power.
Yeah,
and that was fascinating. So you've got these thinking, why are there oak trees in Stellenbosch High Street? Well, they're there because they're a political project to sort of Europeanize African landscape.
It's fascinating. I was doing a talk with the Australian radio station, and beforehand I was realizing that there was this issue going on in Australia and New Zealand because the same process had taken place in the 19th century, and there was an argument to be removing these oaks from certain, which you can understand. I get that.
But then things move, and over time,
absolutely.
It's not just animals move, but plants kind of change their distribution. And is it natural or is it human? And there are no kind of simple answers to these things. There are no binaries. But I think they're kind of it's almost helpful just to have the conversation about what you see, why it's there, what it means. Going back to kind of individual trees, I remember being in the high Sierra Nevada in California several times, where there are bristlecone pines that are individuals 4,500 years old.
Yeah.
And then you just kind of map that onto human history and think, well, that individual, that single living thing, has sat and watched all of this change. Does that make us feel differently? Well, I think it does, actually. I think I hope that it makes us a bit more kind of humble and a bit more caring for what's there and a little less careless about the world. Sure. But if we were looking forward now, where are you feeling kind of with your understandings of birds and of trees and of nature and the way that we try to understand it and then communicate it through all sorts of media, through writing, but also in other forms. Are you feeling kind of confident about how things are at the moment? I mean, a couple of weeks ago, the Kunming Declaration was actually signed in China for biodiversity. So we've got something kind of internationally agreed that we hoped would happen some time ago. And now you could say that's just words at this point.
I mean, I think the recognition that the role conservation plays in protecting biodiversity, and through that, the role of things like preserving peat moorland and forest as forms of carbon capture. I mean, the mitigation effects of some of these conservation policies to help with climate change is very important. Importance of salt marsh and so on. So I think seeing that connection between biodiversity and climate change and the role of conservation in protecting biodiversity and therefore mitigating climate change is very important. I mean, sometimes the debate about climate change seems to sometimes suppress the one about biodiversity and they sometimes pull in a different direction. I mean, some of the slightly, I'd say, obsessive concern with planting trees everywhere might be good for climate change, but it absolutely ruins biodiversity if you put it in the wrong places or the wrong trees in the wrong place. It needs to be a bit more sort of nuancing. I mean, Robert McFarland on Desert Island Disc said, the right trees in the right place.
Yeah.
That's what you need, councils have targets to plant a million trees or something, and you think, well, that might not be great for biodiversity if it's in a nice...
It avoids the more important bit, which is actually is how we consume, how we live our lives, how we produce stuff and use things is a much bigger effect. I mean, for example, if you plant 10 trees, it takes 10 years to save a ton of carbon. If you convert to a vegetarian diet, you'll save 0.7 of a tonne every year for those 10 years. Yeah. So consumption patterns are going to be more important than changes to habitat. But we need to do both. We're going to need biodiversity and carbon capture in alongside.
And there's definitely sort of good signs. You know, I mean, the MA Wild Writing that we've run here at Essex since 2009, you know, Jules, I know you were instigating in that, and you know, it's been great. It's run along. We've had incredible people from all over the world taking the course, but we've never had as many as we've got at the moment. And they are, you know, a mixture of younger people, older people, but people who want to have this kind of discussion, you know, but not in half an hour, but across a whole year or 2 years, you know. And I do find that really encouraging. And, you know, that kind of the nuances of exploring literature, landscape, environment, culture, climate change, you know, that's all part of what we're doing, really, isn't it?
I think there are also interesting developments in there's a big debate going on about what's called low carbon ornithology. Mm. And looking at the way in which you know, ornithology, which looks like on the face of it, it's a very, you know, pro environmental activity. You're supporting the buying of, you know, conservation of land, but it can involve forms of behaviour that are very high carbon, very high. Yeah. So, you know, lots of travelling around the world and lots of driving to sort of distant locations in the UK. So, I think these are very difficult things in terms of changing those kinds of behaviours. But people are trying to say, well, you know, what about local patch birding?
Yeah.
Birding by, if you can do it by public transport, by bike, if you can do that, travel less, travel differently. And that's a really important debate, I think, mm-hmm. you know, because mm-hmm. otherwise people sort of don't see the destructive aspects of their behaviours, which look on the on the surface to be kind of pro-conservation, pro-biodiversity, but actually might be.
Yeah, because that's when birding becomes consuming, doesn't it, as well, in that sense?
It's the sporting aspects of it.
You buy all the kit, have you seen, this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Travelling, twitching things, going, driving up to Yorkshire for the day to see something.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
I don't do this, just to be clear.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
Well, I mean, I'm
sure you don't.
There are all sorts of ways of engagement, aren't there, here? So let's kind of bring this together to finish with just a couple of thoughts about how you've seen people's lives changed by their engagement with nature in the broader sense, or specifically with birds or with trees or even oak trees. What when you see that engagement, what are you observing about people's individual lives and what they look like? I mean, I'm kind of looking for an angle about improvement, but it may not be that. I mean, people may see it in a different kind of way. But through that, how does the world change, and how do individuals change?
Well, I mean, I think you know, birds give people a way into the wider natural environment. So they become aware of, you know, trees and plants and insects, the interconnection of birds with the rest of the web of life. And so I do think it draws people into what I earlier called more than human worlds, this connection with the wider natural world and interdependence. But I mean, I think it also is an emotional connection.
Yep.
And it's about, you know, I suppose you say it's about re-enchanting the world and your relationship with the world.
Yep.
It brings back, you know, kind of version of magic, which seems to have disappeared from modern societies. But it is about that connection to something bigger than you. And I think it gives people give people incredible sense of well-being.
And that's what you've seen, that can happen at any stage of life, young students, old students.
Absolutely. It is about the simple stepping into a part of the natural world that you're enjoying and sitting and observing and being immersed in that world. And it can be your local park. It doesn't have to be the exotic, but it's that process. And as Sean's very nicely put it, it's that engagement, it's that emotional connection and the re-recognition that we are of the natural world, not separate, never have been, never will be. And that's absolutely key, I think, to our moving on from here.
Marvellous. Thanks very much indeed to Sean Nixon, to James Canton. We've been talking about the web of life today, which includes us as humans and our interactions with nature and what it all means for the natural world and the social world and how well those are connected together. So thank you very much indeed
to both of you.
That was Louder Than Words. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Have a look at the website for more information, and do rate the pod if you can.